Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus
terms and conditions apply. See website for details. This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Hello, and welcome to Resolved Mysteries. This is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to the cases featured on the show, Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
And I'm Carlin.
And welcome to the show. So as most of you know, for every review we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization, and this month's is Life After Hate, recommended to us by patron Allison H. Another way to support the show is on Patreon. You'll get access to ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks, along with goodies in the mail. Go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast. And just to let you all know, we are taking a break. We're going on a little mini summer hiatus from July 26th to August 25th. But if you're a patron, you'll still get short stacks and you're going to get extra content. So essentially, there won't be a break for you if you're a patron. What are we covering this episode?
Well, I've got a wanted segment about a judge that's not so
fair. Oh, not so fair! See what I did there?
I do see that.
That was good.
Okay.
That's mine, and his name's Judge John Fairbanks.
Okay, and then a little less levies about Paul and Paula Scribner and their sister Sue.
Oh, twins. We love twins.
We do love twins.
All right.
All right.
Let's do it.
So, we are in Newport, New Hampshire for this case.
What?
I feel like we are stuck in New Hampshire.
Yes, what is
for
happening?
For Patreon episodes. For everything. We're in New Hampshire.
I have learned enough about New Hampshire.
We're done. We're done.
Mm-hmm. We're not mad. We just don't want to hang out that much anymore.
I like it. I'm going to live here.
Oh.
No, you don't.
No, you don't.
You're right. I literally have said, I understand why you moved here to my husband.
Could never live there.
Yep.
Sorry. I love you as well, but it's just not.
It's not for you.
Not for me.
So, Judge John Fairbanks had been a judge for 33 years in Newport. Newport, New Hampshire didn't have a very busy justice court system. So he was also still able to run a very successful law firm specializing in probate law. Fairbanks was well liked and known for being very honest and described as a quote, great guy. So you know it's going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
You know you can count on that.
Mm-hmm.
He was a respected pillar of the society. He handled many of the money affairs of his clients, especially widows.
Oh.
Oh.
How convenient.
So the first woman that we see, one of his clients, her name is Jean Kennerson. Her husband had recently passed away, but he had grown up with John Fairbanks in the town, and her husband had used Fairbanks for like any legal things that he had when he was still alive. So she hired him to settle his estate. If you don't remember, Jean Kennerson is wearing a knitted sweater. And there's also a crocheted afghan behind her.
Oh.
It's just a full yarn party. And peeking over her shoulder is a doll.
Ooh.
In the talking head. Just one. How? One red-headed doll.
Did I not see that?
Don't know. We'll post it on the Instagram.
Okay.
And so that's what you need to know about Jean. She's a true sweetie. Oh, I'm looking at the doll right now. It's literally
Uh-oh.
A frizz of red hair, black eyes.
Oh, no.
And the nose is right at the same line as the eyes, so you know it's good.
No. I'm seeing it in my nightmares right now.
Okay. So this is the first woman that we see. She just talks a little bit about how he came to see her. Then we see a reenactment of him coming to her door. And then we don't hear from her anymore for right now. Now we're introduced to another Newport resident and client of Judge John Fairbanks, who could be Carlin's grandmother. Her name is Patricia Sawyer.
Is she the one that was just straightforward and just like,
yes!
Yes, yes. Honey, I had the same thought. She reminded me of one of my grandmas.
Yes.
Yes.
So nice.
It was so nice. She's such a honey. We love her. So this is Patricia Sawyer. John Fairbanks had helped her settle her husband's estate previously. She's like quite old at the time of this airing. And he also had like always helped her with her income taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And then in August of 1987, because so many people in her family had died, like her husband, her uncle, she was just used to like settling other people's estates and needing help with that. So she decided to have Fairbanks help her get her things in order for when she died. And she also turned over all of her stock certificates to him.
Mm-hmm.
So he could inventory all of her stock holdings. And so you see her in his office. First of all, she's wearing this amazing green and black, big checkered fleece coat. It's a dream. And you see him just rubbing his grubbies all over all these stock certificates, just putting them in different piles. You can tell he's like very excited. He also might be wearing a bald cap. This reenactor. There's a lot to see in the photos. And he's saying, he's really good, this actor. And he's like, you don't have any idea what all this is worth now, do you, Patricia? And she's like, no, I have no idea. And like clearly hamming it up for the reenactment, but like trying to show that he's going to take her. So he told her he would sort all of her stocks out. But then every time she would call him about it to say like, where are you at with this? How much do I have in my holdings? Why am I not getting dividends? He just said he was unable to work on it or hadn't gotten to it yet and was so busy. So October 19th, not 12th like the show says, 1987, Black Monday occurred on Wall Street. So there's a stock market crash. Yeah, it's not great, but Fairbanks tried not to panic, and we hear about this because his clerk, Jan Corliss, is a talking head, and she says on that day he got, like, a note given to him during, you know, just regular court proceedings. He's like, we need to take a brief recess. He goes back. He tells his clerk, if it's a stock market crash, the way to survive it is to not panic. But then she also says that he seemed like put out and annoyed because that day was also his 65th birthday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And so he didn't like that the stock market crashed on his 65th birthday.
So rude.
That must have been really hard for him.
And then he also told her that if he just stayed calm and did not panic, then he would not lose the $6.5 million that he had in the stock market.
Yeah,
what in 1987.
Was that? What does that equal?
That's like double.
$12 million?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Also, think about the note that was passed to him. Was it just like a poster that said, you're fucked?
Yes. I hope it was just pictures, like a drawing, a doodle.
Like an IKEA instruction manual. It was just like a man jumping out of a building.
Yeah. So within a month, Patricia, who is Carlin's grandma, came to see him and she asked, like, why am I not receiving dividend checks from my stocks? And he claimed that all of her stocks had lost value due to the crash and that he was turning the checks back in, her dividend checks back in, so that the stocks would not lose value. That's what he told her. Do I understand how the stock market works or stocks? No, I don't.
That's why we're not rich.
I just loved the savvy of this woman.
Oh.
Because that would be my grandmother, too, because she was a bookkeeper from Montgomery Ward.
Yeah.
And she knew the fucking details, baby.
Yeah, she would know. Okay, so then our next victim is John H. Tweedy. And friends, John Tweedy had a pipe. He had a hat.
Did he have a sweater?
He had a sweater. He was just a very down-to-earth man.
Mm.
He was a honey. Well, he is a honey. I think he's probably dead now, but he was and is a honey. And we'll post pictures.
One can be a honey beyond the grave, I feel. Yes, honey. A dapper gent.
Yeah, so John Tweedy had made Fairbanks like kind of the legal money overseer for his brother Richard, who suffered from schizophrenia and lived in a mental institution. Mm-hmm. So Fairbanks was like in charge of all of his estate. And in November of 1988, John Tweedy met with Fairbanks to discuss concerns about his brother's holdings. And so we see this reenactment of Fairbanks coming to John Tweedy's house, and they've like clearly known each other a long time. But when he asked Fairbanks about his brother's estate, he seemed to be avoiding him and avoiding having to answer. And then he said, "Why didn't you tell me that my brother's estate is in the red?"
Mm.
And Fairbanks just says, "Oh, well, you're just a hard man to get a hold of. You know what? You just come down to my office in a couple days and we will get it all sorted out. Don't worry." So
that's an excuse you could not make today. Like, I've been trying to reach you. And
yeah. No.
Because we know.
And also, this guy, John Tweedy, is not a hard guy to get a hold of. He, like, lives in his home and he does woodworking.
He's got that pipe. He's super cozy. You know where to find him.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Okay, so, but we love John Tweedy, and he was very suspicious. He saw right through it. He began his own investigation. We see him at a big, big, big table in the dark, crunching numbers with a calculator, 2 Band-Aids on each joint of every finger.
Oh, honey.
And what is that about? What is that?
Maybe psoriasis? I don't know.
It could be. Okay, so truly though, and again, I've got close-up photos of the hand with the Band-Aids on every joint of the finger.
Oh my gosh, I was not paying enough attention.
But during all this number crunching with his Band-Aided fingers, he found at least $20,000 was missing from his brother's estate because Fairbanks had sold stock and underreported what he had received for dividends. So he's selling stocks and then reporting, oh, at this one I only got 10,000 or, you know, whatever. I don't know what's money, but.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say, I don't know what's money?
But if no one had looked, no one would have found it.
Yeah.
So Tweedy is a hero. So John Tweedy contacted the police and reported Judge John Fairbanks, which would be really hard in this, like, I don't know how big this town is, but it seems like it's got a small town atmosphere and everyone knew him and he'd been a judge forever. And it would be weird to like be like, actually, the one of the judges in the town is stealing thousands of dollars from people, because you might think the police won't listen to you. I don't know. So investigators listened to Tweedy, though, and they discovered that Fairbanks owned several large and expensive homes in different states, and that seemed suspicious for the amount of money he should have been making as a judge and lawyer. So on June 6, 1989, Fairbanks resigned from the bench and told his clerk to find a replacement for him. And he retreated to his summer home in Maine. No problem. When John Tweedy's charges were made public, other clients eventually came forward with their suspicions, like Patricia Sawyer. She discovered that Fairbanks had placed her stocks into stock brokerage firms, even though she had not given him authority to do so. And in total, this woman lost $500,000.
I cannot.
To this asshole.
Oh my God.
So investigators believed that Fairbanks had stolen so much money from various clients that he had completely cleaned out their accounts. Some people were saying he might have stolen up to $10 million in a 20-year period. So they realize he is in his summer home in Maine. They contact him there and they're like, we need to talk to you. And he says, oh, yeah, yeah, we can meet on this day. And then he doesn't show up. And then they call again. He's like, yeah, yeah, we can meet on this day. He doesn't show up. And he is not seen from after that. So December 28th, 1989, he's indicted on 4 counts of theft. The indictments listed more than 100 checks written by Fairbanks, and the checks transferred money from clients' accounts to his personal accounts. The next day after that, his pickup truck was found near his main home, but he was nowhere around. So then the first woman that I told you about, Jean Kennerson, who has the doll behind her, she lost $100,000 to him.
Yep. Ugh.
And then Patricia Sawyer, who lost $500,000, said, quote, this has affected my life to the fact that I wonder what I am going to do, and I am going to have to sell land and maybe sell the farm, and the farm has been in my family since the original settlers came. I mean, this woman, it has to be 85 at least, 85 or 90.
Oh my God. Her entire life.
Her entire life. And she's so, like, matter of fact and just like a survivor, but also like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Like,
are you kidding? Oh my God. Okay, so then we do see an update tacked on to the end of the show. So I'm just going to tell you that old Judge John Fairbanks got to live 5 years on the lam, living his life, spending his victims' money. And then in Las Vegas, it is possible that he had seen the police chief of Sunapee, New Hampshire, who was among one of the original investigators in the case. His name's Alan Soucy, and he's not the investigator that was on a talking head on the show. But he happened to be in Las Vegas in 1994. And then a few days later, Judge John Fairbanks' body was found in a Las Vegas hotel room, and he had died by suicide. Mm. So Alan Soucy thinks maybe he saw him in the same hotel casino that he was found dead in. Oh, and he thought, oh my God, he's going to see me. I'm going to just die now.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Yeah. So one thing UM didn't talk about. So after he goes on the lam, the clients, of course, sued for their money back. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't find if, I think this happened before he was found. His property was just sold. Like all of his properties were sold and like liquidated his funds. And his victims only got 21 cents on the dollar from that for what they sued for.
Ugh.
So they like did not recoup even 50%. Like,
oh my God.
20%. And other than that, after he was found, no large amounts of money were ever found. So it seems like he either hid the money or he just spent it all before he died.
I know. I was like, what did he spend it on?
He didn't have that much time. And that's a lot of money.
Yes. Yeah. A lot.
But he also, I was like, why aren't they mentioning his family? Mm. Apparently, some people think that he began stealing money in the 1950s when he was starting to cite irregularities with an account that belonged to the city of Claremont when he's like starting, you know, his law practice. And then I was like, where's his family? He apparently had 4 children.
Oh my God.
And he would spend tons of money on them, building expensive homes in Newport and in Maine. marble countertops, 3 2-car garages, landscaping.
Whoa.
One of the houses was probably $600,000 to build, which in that time is so much money.
In the 80s?
Mm-hmm.
Marble countertops.
You know it's high.
That is some high rolling.
So that's it. He's a dick bitch. That's rude. Yeah. I couldn't find his kids.
Probably intentionally.
They probably don't want to be found.
Yeah.
Truly.
Oh, it's not great. But yeah, it is interesting. Like, none of them were on the UM segment.
No.
Because they were using his money liberally.
I know. I'm so curious. Did they talk to him after he disappeared, do you think?
Yes.
Oh.
If he had been footing the bill for that long, yes.
And he there had to have been
some contact. Even if it was them asking, where's the money? Like, what does this mean for us?
I wonder if he ever told them, like, hey, just so you know, if they get close to finding me, I'm going to do this. Or that if that was know. Totally
Probably
out of...
Probably not. I can't see it. I mean, I don't know.
Because then, yeah, I don't know.
To speculate, I can't imagine a dad that played the role of hero and buying all this cool stuff and doing all this. I can't imagine him then saying, if it comes down, I'm going to take my own. I don't see that. But, yeah, I can see them not saying anything because they benefited from it for so long.
Oh, that's sad.
They all have marble countertops at this point, so.
Everybody's got a marble countertop.
Everybody.
True story, I hate my hair. I have the thinnest, flattest, most baby-fine hair that you have ever seen. I also have terrible skin allergies to hair products, and that leaves my scalp super itchy and unhappy. I have tried zillions of products with zero success, but I have recently found products that actually do what they say they're gonna do. I know, it's shocking. I've started using Gemist. I took their quick 2-minute quiz, and their fancy schmancy algorithm matched me with the best shampoo and conditioner and a scalp balancing bar. I have to admit, I had no idea what a scalp balancing bar was, but I went for it anyway. It removed buildup and soothed the insane itchiness that I get from using hair care products. The shampoo gave my hair actual volume. Crazy, right? And the conditioner left my hair shiny and really soft and not like weighted down and gross. Also, the products smell really good. They put a lot of deliciousness into that scent. I also love the fact that Gemist is owned by a woman. You gotta support the ladies. Most awesome is that if you subscribe, you get 20% off. Right now, our listeners can give Gemist a try and get 20% off their shampoo and conditioner smart subscription. Smart subscribers already save 20% on each order, so this is an amazing deal. Do the math. And with free 2-day shipping, you can have it literally before this weekend. Just visit Gemist.com and get your personalized recommendation and enter mysteries at checkout for 20% off of your subscription and free 2-day shipping. That's Gemist.com, Gemist.com, and enter code mysteries, MYSTERIES, at checkout to get the best hair of your life.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
All right. Segment 3. It's a Lost Loves. And it's about Paul and Paula Scribner. And also Sue. Let's not forget Sue.
Let's not.
So Stack intros by saying, growing up in the 50s in Red Hill, Alabama, life was slow and easy. I think we could have guessed that without Stack telling us. Sue Scribner was the 5th of 10 children and was 13 years old.
Yikes.
One day, Sue came home from church in January of 1957. Her mom, Callista, which, How can we not think of Callista Flockhart?
Yep.
Are there any other
Impossible.
Callistas?
The only Callista.
Her mom, Callista, was alone in the house, which she says was unusual because kids were usually all around, which they don't explain. But, well, no, they said 10 children. Never mind. Sorry.
I don't think they have to say anything else, right?
Yeah.
I need more.
That's the real mystery.
She asks her mom what she's been up to, and she says, just reading the newspaper. She looks at the paper, and her mom had written two names all over the front of it. You know how you do, like, in middle school when you're, like, scribbling names all over a piece of paper or whatever. She asks her what the names are, and she says she'd just seen the names and was writing them out. Sue then asks her mom if she's been crying, and she says that she has a little. Mm. She asks her why, and she tells Sue that she'd had twins, a boy and a girl, who had been adopted. So Sue is interviewed, and her name is now Sue Scribner Thibodeau. And honey, you better believe she is matching both her earrings and her eyeshadow exactly to her blue top.
Absolutely.
Got it.
Perfect match.
It's the trifecta. Earrings, eyeshadow, top. Same color.
Yep. So Sue says she was really surprised, and it's a shock to find out at 13 years old that you have a sister and brother you didn't know about, quote, especially when you have so many brothers and sisters. Sue's mom tells her the story. 2 years before Sue was born, Callista had the twins prematurely. In January of 1942, in Winter Garden, Florida, at Orange County General Hospital, Callista had gone into labor 2 months early. She and Sue's father, Slim Scribner, just, is that not like a comic book character name? What is happening?
Slim Scribner.
So she and Slim rushed to the hospital, and the twins were born shortly after. So then, Callista and Slim named the twins Paul and Paula after their doctor, Paul Harder. Which is a very sweet sentiment, but, like, I just feel like that's something you're going to hate as you grow older, to be named Paul and Paula. Anyway.
Yeah.
The doctor tells them that the babies are so small that they will have a lot of health problems. He says there is a heart condition and a blood disorder. Yeah. Slim asks if the babies are okay, and the doctor says yes, and they will require a great deal of medical attention. So Sue explains to us that her mother says the reason the twins were put up for adoption was because they needed surgery for a congenital heart disease, and they couldn't afford it. It's just so heartbreaking. Like, the only way to save your child's lives are to give them away.
Yeah,
it's horrible. Horrible, horrible, horrible. Callista tells the doctor that she knows someone perfect to adopt the twins, and they would be able to pay for the medical expenses. Sue explains that her mother never got over the twins being adopted, and of course she didn't. Mm. Stack tells us that before Callista left the hospital, she made a solemn promise to Dr. Harder that she would never search for the twins. And I'm just like, why? What? Why? What? Your doctor has nothing to do with this. Why?
I think they do kind of handle, like, they might have had more of a hand in handling the social work aspect of the adoption back then, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
That's so weird. So in 1944, Slim and Callista got divorced, and she got remarried, and her new husband raised 10 children. When Callista died in 1979, Sue enlisted the whole family to search for the twins. Hmm. It's just so sad. Like, she really kept that promise, even though it killed her.
Yeah.
Sue's father and Dr. Harder had also passed away, and the hospital records were sealed. Then, Stack says, a rusty trunk in an attic finally yielded a clue.
We love it.
We love a rusty trunk, honey.
Yeah, we do.
In 1987, one of Sue's cousins found a letter that Callista had written to her mother after the twins were born. The cousin noted that Callista had never mentioned adoption in the letter, and it sounded like she had actually planned to bring the twins home. She wrote to her mother about how the twins had been gaining weight, which was progress. She writes to her mother that the doctor also told her she may be able to bring them home the following week. Sue says that everything her mom wrote matched up to what she had told her, but there was one thing the letter didn't clear up, is when the twins were adopted. She says in the letter, you can tell she did not intend for them to be adopted. Stack tells us that that the discovery of the letter ignited new interest in the twins' story. Several newspapers wrote about the twins, and one of them paid off. In May 1990, one of Sue's nieces, living in Mobile, Alabama, received an anonymous phone call. The person on the other line seemed, quote, elderly and very emotional.
Oh, yeah.
The person told her that the twins were alive, she knew the family, but they didn't know they were adopted. She says that she knew where Paul and Paula were. The woman said she planned to tell the children they were adopted on Mother's Day, which seems like a strange choice. She says that she plans to tell them the whole truth, and then the cousin would be hearing from her again, or the twins would contact her. So Sue's cousin Gina, who is the twins' niece, says she started calling everyone and telling them they'd found the twins. She says she counted the days and the hours, and she stayed at home, like she wouldn't go anywhere, hoping she was going to get this call, but then the call never came. So Sue wrote an open letter to the twins that was printed in newspapers in the surrounding area. Sue reads some of it, and it's, like, very poetic. It's more of a poem than a letter, I would say.
Yes, I thought so, too.
Then, don't worry, Mr. Stack says that 10 days after the story aired, Sue received an anonymous call from a viewer who said the twins were living in Orlando, Florida. Sue immediately contacted her brother and sister, whose names were now Bruce and Barbara. I don't know what's going on with these
things. The alliteration.
The alliteration.
It's a crime.
The twins had no idea they were adopted. And they're like 50.
That's crazy.
Or that they had a large family. So Stack tells us that on March 15th, 1992, Sue Scribner met her brother and sister for the first time in her life. Six of the Scribner siblings and their families were able to come to the reunion. Quote, the very first time we met him, I think all our knees were shaking. It is emotional, but I think we've all cried enough tears and we didn't need a lot today. Bruce says, so I think that my newfound family is wonderful. I think they're absolutely adorable. It's like we've known each other all our lives, and even though we haven't been around each other more than 5 years. Sue says, I can't wait to get to know them finally. I'm very excited about it. Barbara says, you have all these questions in your mind. Gee, what did I miss out on all these years? What were they really like as kids? Bruce says, I think everybody is going to get to know each other, both sides of the family, and for country bumpkins like we are, it's a blessing. Sue says, it doesn't really matter now what kind of life that any of us had because it's what's left that counts. We know where all the children are now. Aww. So they're just a bunch of sweeties.
Yeah. Really.
So just a little bit of research. They were nicknamed the Coffee Pot Twins because their combined weight equaled a bag of coffee.
Oh my gosh.
What?
Too nice. So thank God fandom.com had linked one article about this case because I didn't expect to find anything. It ran in the Orlando Sentinel in 1992 and it's written by Daryl E. Owens. So that's where all the info is from. So more on the story of Callista. Callista and Slim actually had 4 children before the twins. As we know, the twins were put up for adoption because the couple didn't have enough money for their surgery.
Yeah.
When Callista and Slim got divorced, he actually left her. Because Callista couldn't support all of the kids by herself, 2 were put in orphanages and 2 were put in a boys' home, which I don't know how that's different from an orphanage, but it was noted as different things. After Callista got remarried and got back on her feet, she got all of the children back except for the twins. So she actually, like, made some money and got her children back.
Wow. And I guess it was just because she was told about the health problems?
I don't know, or if she couldn't find, I'm not sure. Huh. It's kind of unclear. So according to this article, Callista, quote, always hoped for a reunion. So I don't know if they meant secretly or if UM was wrong about her being so secretive about never looking for them. Because she had, like, said she made this promise to never look for them.
Yeah.
The twins had been adopted by a couple named Franklin and Elma Cashin. They had passed away in the early 80s, so they were gone by the time the two families found each other. And then this, Bruce Cashin, Paul, actually saw the segment on UM. Quote, I thought, wouldn't it be funny if me and Barbara, his twin sister, were them? God. Not thinking it was possible.
Oh my gosh.
So he watches this whole segment. He's like, oh, that would be so funny if that was me and Barbara.
That's crazy.
But then not long after was when the twins found out they were adopted and their siblings were looking for them.
Crazy.
The twins' older sister, Martha, from their adoptive family, had also recently found out that she was adopted from an aunt. And it was Martha who told the twins that they were adopted.
Whoa.
Quote, I thought she was coming over to talk about the taxes on my trailer, Bruce said. She pulled out a newspaper article that said we were adopted, but we didn't know we were the Scribners. So this is the same newspaper article I got all my information from. Mm-hmm. The twins contacted Gina Urbanek, their biological niece. Quote, "I was in shock," said Barbara. "I started crying and said, this can't be true. Somebody had to prove it to me." So they actually had to get a lawyer in order to get access to their adoption papers to confirm everything. Quote, "I'm very excited that with my brother and sisters, I can learn about and find myself in them," said Barbara Cashin, who works at Woolworths in Colonial Plaza. Quote, "I was so shocked to find out that we're not the only original copies walking around." Quote, "It was like seeing myself in the mirror," said Bruce Cashin, who shares the family's red hair and fair skin. "It was weird." The Cashins say it's almost like being adopted for a second time at age 50. The twins say they can't wait for more family reunions. Wow. Quote, "They've got a proud sense of heritage and have all the confidence in the world," Bruce said. "Through the grace of God, this was allowed to happen and for us to find each other."
Wow.
And then I did find the whole letter that she had written to Paula and Paula, and it was called In Search of the Coffee Pot Twins.
Oh.
And I'm not going to read it, but it is very much like poetic and nice. And it's published online, and so this little message was below it, and it says, "True story. This is an open letter I sent to Unsolved Mysteries. They came to Baton Rouge from California the next week for an interview, and we did the show. We found the twins through Unsolved Mysteries. We live so far apart, it is difficult to get together, but have had several reunions and lots of phone conversations. It is felt that my father, the doctor, and their adopted father made all the arrangements, leaving my mother out of the decision."
See the doctor.
Oh, man.
"She never really got over that. She asked that we wait until she died to search for them. She had not agreed with the adoption, and my father did."
Oh, damn.
So, yeah, that's all I have.
Wow. That was, I mean, that's sad.
I know.
That part is sad. The rest
but
is
at least
nice.
All the siblings found each other.
Yeah, that's really nice.
And they
nice.
Were just honeys when they all got together.
Oh love my it. Gosh, I love it so much. Oh, good job. We yes. love a lost love.
We do.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So, things to share, things to feel, ladies.
Well, Allison, you took mine.
I
have another
one. I knew I did. I knew it.
You say yours, and I'm going to find the name of a podcast to recommend instead.
Okay. I mean, this is a pretty obvious one if you are into what we're into. The HBO show Mare of Easttown is incredible. It has Kate Winslet, who is amazing.
Queen. An actual queen.
Truly one of my like favorite actresses that I never knew I loved until I realized that she was in everything that I liked. Jean Smart, she's incredible. And then Julianne Nicholson, who I knew from Law & Order, which you can't go wrong. But
is that her friend?
Lori.
Oh, God.
It was actually my partner and my housemate that wanted to watch it because I kind of was tired of the female damage detective narrative. You know, it's sort of a trope now, like the killing does it. And,
exactly.
You know, so I didn't know if it was going to offer anything new, but the performances were incredible. The ability to nail that really specific accent was chef's kiss from someone
when
from
you
the
have
movies.
A British accent.
Yes.
Yeah.
It just sounded like all of the people I know outside of Philly. It was great. And it had a lot to do with the quote unquote crime, but it had way more to do with sort of an emotional journey and grief and sisterhood, I think, not to sound silly, but just it's great. I can't recommend it enough. I knew Eliza was going to recommend it too. That's why I put it in the document first.
So she could have it first.
So that I can own it because it's mine and I love it and it's great. So check it out.
And then I think Allison might have already, whatever it's called, felt or shared this. Did you share I Am Not a Monster already from BBC?
That does not sound familiar.
I don't think so.
Oh, great. Okay. I mean, it's a little bit old. It's like a couple years old, but it's I'm Not a Monster from BBC podcast about this amazing BBC journalist who has been covering the Middle East for a long time. And then he hears about this American who is possibly moved to join ISIS with her children and her husband.
Wow.
And then so he's trying to figure out, did the husband force her to go there, or did she know that she was going to join ISIS with her husband? Okay. It is very good. And the journalist, again, is just amazing. So give it a listen. And then, you know, Allison and I love Against the Odds. I listen to every episode the second it comes out. Honey, there's a new series, K2 Savage Mountain, all about summiting K2, which reminded me of the movie Into Thin Air, which is about Mount Everest. And honey, we love it all. It's the best podcast ever.
It's so fucking good.
Even the John McCain season, I was like, this guy's a Republican. I don't want to listen to this. It was so good.
Yeah.
It was so amazing.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Oh, love. John McCain's amazing.
He is. Oh. It reaches across the aisle. It's so good.
Oh. Incredible. And then they usually have an episode at the end interviewing someone who was like a big part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Oh, everyone must listen. Thai Cave Rescue, start there. So fucking good.
Yeah.
Against the Odds.
Agreed. Agreed.
Mine, I've only listened to one episode so far, but I cried, so should probably talk about it. So the same people that did the Confronting OJ have done Confronting Columbine.
Oh, girl, how do you get in on this?
I know you guys cannot.
Mass shooting stuff.
No way.
I know that you cannot. But it's not hosted by, but kind of narrated by one of the survivors. Her name is Amy Over. So the first episode is all I've heard, but she's just talking about her experience that day. She spends a little time talking about the victims, and that's when I cried, of course.
Oh my gosh.
But so far, it's pretty interesting. I do not know what the other episodes are going to be about, but there's a whole season. So looking forward to more of that. But then my other one was just, I'm so excited for camping. The three of us are going camping together for the first time ever.
Yes.
Which is so weird.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
It only takes 10 years, but there we go.
I know. I've been camping with Allison one other time, but first time all three of us will be together, and I'm really excited. It's going to be really fun, and we're going to have a great time.
It's going to be great.
Oh, reviews. We're going to read a couple reviews to encourage you to write a review if you have not yet.
Yay!
This one was written by the username Awesome? Awesome with a period. And it says, so fun. Give Eliza all of the UFO stories. So funny. This podcast makes the most uninteresting parts of Unsolved Mysteries so much more entertaining.
That's so nice. And also, how dare you? How dare you do that to me? Because they will.
That's it.
And then, ooh, I liked this one because it was, we changed a mind. So this one is titled Amazing, and it's written by Samantha Howland. And it says, seriously, the best podcast around. At first, I was iffy, but I love the energy between you ladies and all the work you do to give such an amazing show. I'm always anxiously waiting for more. You make my workday fly by and enjoyable. XOXO, ladies. Hey. Sam from Ohio.
That's so nice.
Thank you. I love a person that's like, I don't know about this. And then guess what? We're going to keep going until you love us.
Yeah, we're going to wear you down. We're like that.
We'll wear you down.
We're experts at that. Okay. What are we talking about next episode? Episode 5.
It's a missing segment about Baron 52.
And then I have a wanted segment about Paul Stamper.
And I have a wanted segment as well, Josephine White.
Okay, guys. Thanks for sitting with us through this really hot episode.
Are you guys sweaty? Because we're sweaty.
Yeah.
We're so sweaty.
This Portland heat wave has to go right now.
Yeah, that's a no.
We don't have air conditioning in Portland. I don't know if y'all know that. That's not something that we have. We have window units, but we can't run them when we're recording.
We never could have anticipated this global warming.
No
scientists warned us. And, you know.
No one told us.
No one told us.
It's a real surprise. So go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting us there. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you're going to get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies. And you're going to get some episodes while we're on hiatus. So that's great. To see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast and on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box 14005, Portland, Oregon 97293. Send us your stories for listener short stack episodes. If you want to email us your favorite unsolved mystery story or cold case or any nostalgia you have surrounding watching the show, that's great. We've had some amazing, amazing letters from you guys recently, and it's awesome. So we usually say subscribe wherever you get your podcast, but I just talked to a very important person in LA today, and he told me that along with subscribing, you have to share with your friends about this podcast. So if you listen to this podcast and you super love it, and now that it's hot girl summer or hot guy summer or hot they summer, you're out there hanging out with your friends and you're like, hey, I listen to this podcast. And then you just share it with them. If you like us, leave a 5-star review and tell a friend. For every review that we receive, we donate $1 to an organization. And this month's organization is Life After Hate. And we love you so.
Goodbye.
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 Oh, sorry, there was one thing I needed to check on. Let me do that right this moment. I am Googling the words, you can leave all this in, stock market crash 1987.
Oh, yeah.
Is it October 12th or October 19th? Late October, so it must have been the 19th. Interesting. This is interesting. Oh, no, it's not. It's not.
That's what we call a teaser, honey.
What's interesting is... Wait, it is interesting.
Okay, it is. Let's hope it so. Is.
The show fucked up, and I just caught it because I had read that the stock market crash of 1987 happened on October 19th. Guess what? That's right. But Stack tells us it was October 12th of 1987, and he was wrong. He got it wrong.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Embarrassing.
Embarrassing. Leave all of that in. It was really, you know, a little peek behind the curtain.